Welcome again to Real Wealth Podcast. This is Mike Proctor, sponsored by Leading Edge Financial Planning. And today we have Mr. Tim O'Sullivan. Tim is one of the best estate planners in the state. He's helped write some laws at the Medicaid level, help shape what laws determine what happens when you die, when you need care, and also what impacts different trusts in some certain ways. So Tim has really been involved with that. He's a professor at
Washburn University.
Thank you. I don't know why my mind went blank on that.
I understand that.
Professor up at Washburn, teaching estate planning law, and he's a senior partner at Fulston Siefkin. It's a very large firm, even amongst firms in the U.S., and started right here in Wichita. So, right?
Yes, glad to be here.
Okay. All right. And so anyways, today we're going to talk about estate planning. And this is really important as far as how we live the best life possible, is knowing that things are taken care of and also leaving the best life possible for those that we are going to leave an inheritance to. Even if it's not a large inheritance, some of the most expensive probate cases arise from things that aren't worth necessarily much monetary value, maybe high emotional or family or heirloom value.
Yeah, they take on a whole new value when the parent passes away.
That's right. That's right. So today we're going to talk about why there is at least one major flaw in the vast majority of estate plans. And Tim's going to share his stories, experience with us today. So thank you so much, Tim, for coming on.
Glad to be here.
All right. Well, Tim, I'll let you just kind of jump in and take it away. What is the one major big flaw in most estate plans?
The one I've emphasized probably for the last 20 years of my practice is not maintaining family harmony in the estate planning process. And when you implement the estate plan following the client's death. And there are many factors that go into that. Michael, you're very familiar with this. Who's going to be the fiduciary of the estate? We're talking about the executor under will or trustee, usually under revocable trust. And most clients will pick a child. They just do. Usually the oldest child, and they go from there down to the youngest, succession, not thinking about how that might impact their estate plan following their death.
Right. So they're essentially saying the oldest kid or sometimes just the person that seems most connected to either the financial or legal industry or accounting industry, something along the lines of there's money to be handled. Oh, I should pick them. They should be the one to settle it out, get things cleaned up. They know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And often there's nobody in that particular field, so they go with the oldest child because that's the easiest. They can explain that the easiest. Yeah, I'm not picking favorites. We just go with the oldest, and children will usually understand that, going with the oldest down to the youngest. So, mm-hmm.
Now, just because they're oldest, does that mean that they know what to do to settle an estate or that they even want to take the time if they knew what to do?
Absolutely not. Most of them don't know anything about managing an estate. And all the things that can happen when a parent dies come into play with siblings. Now, you usually don't going to have any family harmony problem if you have just one child, obviously. But if you have more than one child, picking a child has a very high frequency of disharmony. I know that. I've pulled enough audiences I've talked to. It's in the 40 to 50% range. Serious disharmony. It's very costly to the estate. And it comes from a variety of areas. Why did mom pick me or dad pick me? They have already a grudge with their siblings about one thing or another. And parents are probably the poorest judge of disharmony following their death. They always kind of rose-colored glasses. It'll work out fine. They get along fine. But you really don't know a family until you've been through an estate together with them. It's one of my quotes I use a lot. You don't. You'll see things post-death that you never saw during lifetime and sides of their children. And a child is like they have no experience in what they're doing, usually. So you pick a child, and it's much like I tell clients, it's much like picking a manager of a business who has no experience at it and likely to have personality conflicts with employees. That's probably not somebody you would pick, but that's exactly what happens when you name a child in the majority of cases. That's why it's such a high frequency. And it can be over-distributing the personal effects. It could be not getting the property when they think they should. Their brother or sister's not communicating with them often enough. Hardly ever is often enough. They're not consulting with them. Well, they shouldn't have to, major decisions, because that's their decision. But I mean, it's nice to do that, but they every little decision they think that their brother or sister should communicate with them about. Taking too long to administer the estate. They don't think their brother or sister should take a fee for it. They think they should do it for nothing. They're very usually unappreciative, which makes it even more disharmonious if they're not appreciative of what their brother or sister's doing. So it's a lot of factors, but it's a very high frequency of disharmony when a parent names a child.
Okay.
Well, and there's more than one child, of course.
On top of that, what if they did know how to distribute an estate? What if they did know how to do everything perfectly? We're also talking about introducing complex issues into a group of family members that aren't objective because they're the ones that are on the receiving end. But even if they play perfectly well together, they're grieving. So their brains are working totally different than they normally would.
It's not just how they're administering the estate, but their perception of how they're managing it.
Yeah.
And you still have the communication issues. It's not being done fast enough. Why wasn't I picked? I mean, you get into all this. That's still there.
Yeah. And the grief along with it.
Oh, sure.
Piled on top for all of them.
Yeah.
That's and they're trying to relate well, but they are grieving.
That's another aspect I've iterated quite often. It's very emotionally tense. And the glue that held the family together, last surviving parent, is gone now. So everything's kind of opened up, all these different issues that come to the forefront. A lot of which the parents never saw while they were living. So
that's right. Yeah, because you're trying to anticipate what's going to happen by looking at what hasn't happened yet.
Exactly.
They can't conceive what it's going to be like once they're gone.
No, they can't. Absolutely not.
Yeah. Right. So let's talk about complexities in terms of a family unit that stayed one family unit over time. And then later we can talk a little bit about blended families and how complicated
sure.
that can get.
Oh, yes, that's even worse.
Yeah. So why don't you share a little bit more about the complications of an estate and what value a corporate trustee brings to the table? And when we say corporate trustee, that just means it's somebody that's hired as an outside party to administer the estate. To decide when money is distributed, to sign for things. So instead of a beneficiary being the one to make those type of decisions amongst other beneficiaries. So what value does that bring? If you could just speak
to that.
Well,
I might just say that a lot of clients are going to say this is a family matter. And I say, no, it's not. It's a financial and business matter, a legal matter. It just happens to involve family assets. That's the problem. They view it as a family matter, but it clearly is not that. So if you go to outside the family, somebody knows what they're doing, totally independent from the family, you're going to get objective decision-making. And they won't be fighting among themselves. In fact, I've never had one, in conjunction with other clauses we put in the documents to minimize disharmony, besides just the fiduciary, I can't conceive of one major family disharmony problem we've had since doing that, going outside the family, if somebody knows what they're doing. And I tell clients, lawyers are not usually a good choice. It's against my economic interest to tell you that, so you probably should believe me. We make more money if we serve as trustee or executor. But we don't like to do it. I wouldn't want to do it. It's not. I like to plan estates and avoid problems. I don't want to be in the middle of them by being a trustee or executor. We don't have bookkeepers on staff. We don't have or accountants. And third parties will keep much better records than we will. And if you don't like the job you're doing, what kind of a job are you going to do? You probably put off some things you probably shouldn't be putting off. That's just human nature. And does our malpractice insurance cover us? That's another issue we come to play. So all these factors together and our fees being too high, hourly rates for lawyers are way too high to administer an estate. You're doing estate sales. You're answering calls from family members. What's that going to be? $200-$300 an hour? I mean, it's just way too high. So those
or more.
Could be. Yeah. I mean, I just dealt with one in Washington, D.C., $1,400 an hour.
Ooh.
And they're even higher sometimes in California. I mean, you're talking some couple thousand dollars an hour. But we're, I think, more reasonable in Kansas. But nonetheless, it's still too high as opposed to a third party. So somebody that knows what they're doing, the advantage of professional trustees like corporate fiduciaries is they're bonded. Because if you go with anybody else who's not, are they bonded? If they mess up, is there any way to get the money back besides suing them if they don't have the money in their accounting firm or whatever, you might just lose it all. So that's the other problem with children. Because if they make a mistake, their siblings will probably be unforgiving about the mistakes. They shouldn't have made that mistake. They may not be getting enough advice when they do the estate or trust, which means they're more prone to mistakes. And so third parties can do it efficiently. They're coming by malpractice. They do a good job, great records. They know what they're doing in taxes, getting tax ID numbers. They know the provisions of the law and managing trusts, who they're supposed to give notice to. Then they're very good at it. So if you go an experienced corporate fiduciary, fine. You could go with a CPA as well. But does a CPA, what's their hourly rate for doing it? Are they covered by malpractice insurance? How much experience do they have? CPAs are very good at taxes and accounting, but if they haven't had a lot of experience in managing trusts and knowing about the laws such as Uniform Trust Code, for example, they're not going to be near as good as somebody who knows what they're doing and has more experience at it. So experience is a factor. If you had a CPA that's got a lot of experience, they probably might be a good candidate. But that's certainly a condition before you'd ever hire them if they've got experience in doing that particular aspect, i.e. managing a trust or estate.
Right. And I could see how it'd be easy for somebody to say, well, that all sounds really good, but it sounds expensive enough that I just want to have my kids do it.
Now you're talking expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because a child should go to an attorney or an accountant for advice on accounting, attorney for legal aspects of it. They often don't. They make mistakes by not doing that. If they do, I just say, ka-ching, ka-ching, you're paying lawyers and accountants. Figure what that would cost as relationship to a third-party trustee who doesn't need to call lawyers and accountants to do that. I've done a kind of informal thinking in my own mind about what that would be. And for if we have a third-party corporate fiduciary, the times I get called for advice as opposed to an individual is about 20%, one-fifth, maybe my guess. So you're not going to have near as much attorney and accounting fees outside by having a core fiduciary as a child who should be getting that advice. They skimp on getting outside advice. That's going to be penny wise, probably, and pound foolish and making mistakes, costly to the estate or trust that their siblings are not going to forgive them for.
Right. So what is it? What does it cost to have a corporate trustee typically?
Well, normally, of course, it varies across the country, but I would say 1-2% maybe. Around here, unless it's a smaller estate, it might be 2% or so. And if it's a larger estate, 1% would probably be the tops to manage that. So it's very, very efficient. And people pay 1% to do their investments, maybe for your advice. But then, I don't want to pay 1% to have somebody manage my estate with the most valuable thing I have in terms of going to my children, my entire wealth. You need to talk, we as lawyers need to advise our clients about, you know, their perspective on this whole thing and making smart decisions. And it's usually a good financial decision to go outside the family, not just the family harmony aspects of it.
Yeah. So talk more about what attorneys should be advising their clients on or why they may be the culprit.
Or what I didn't do early in my career.
Yeah, that'd be great.
They should advise them about starting with what are their goals as a family. Family values need to be incorporated in the estate plan. I was talking about you earlier, family value estate planning is what I'm calling it. Because the things that cause problems and costs are usually not incorporating family values in the estate plan, like family harmony. That is usually the number one goal that clients have. The kids do not fight over their estates. I've asked many clients that. What's more valuable, the amount you leave to your children or preserving family harmony in the process? And almost invariably, they say family harmony. I'd rather give my assets to charity than have my kids fight over my estate. So if that's going to be the goal, let's make sure we talk about that as lawyers all the way through the estate plan, things that they're doing then cause disharmony. And of course, they have a child and the child comes in to divide up the personal effects in the home. You can imagine how that goes a lot of times. They pick the things that they want the best and the other kids, we get what's left over. And we have a saying in our firm that if you have a child's fiduciary as far as its personal effects, basically it's the child who's got a truck and a key to the house. And I've seen that happen, unfortunately. We call that the pickup doctrine. That's who's going to get the personal property. I was down to a place in Kansas many years ago and talking to a client. They told me about a situation the week before that one of the people in that city died and they had a funeral. And all the kids but one went to the funeral. The other child went and took everything out of the house they wanted while the funeral was going on. It's sad, but stuff like that happens. But a child managing, dividing up the personal effects is, getting back a little bit to family harmony again here, but it's a very important they cannot be objective. They can't be objective about anything they do. It was Abraham Lincoln that says an attorney who represents himself has a fool for a client. Why? We can't be objective. A child cannot be objective about managing a parent's assets and how personal effects are going, anything else. They've got a financial interest in what's going on. That's why it's important that I said go outside the family for that, or at least consider it. My clients, after I go through what the risks are and what the pros and cons are, if they still pick a child, that's the right decision for them. I'm not going to try to dissuade them from that, but I just want pros and cons. And we do not advise them on the pros and cons. As lawyers, I can know that because I didn't do it for about 20 years of my practice. I'm a convert, which means I try to get everybody converted to what I do now. But it's really advisable to do that. I don't think there's a whole lot of debate about this. It's just not done. Not done. And also the provisions in the documents themselves. Family values also include protecting children from things that they cannot protect themselves against, whether minors or whether adults. And if you leave property outright to children or even to a spouse, there's no asset protection to that. You can leave it in trust, and they can be their own trustees. It depends. We can talk about that a little bit later maybe here. But the person that you leave it in trust for can be their own trustee. They can spend the money. The clause is health, education, maintenance, support. It's called an ascertainable standard for themselves, their descendants. They can decide on how those assets go among their family at their death. And in most states that have a uniform trust code, like Kansas does, those are fully protected from every third-party claim. Divorces, creditors, won't be a resource for Medicaid if they go into long-term care with the right language in it. And we all know what the risk of going to long-term care is as people get older. About 40% chance that one of them goes into long-term care and depletes their assets. So you can leave it in trust and get this protection from those things they cannot protect themselves against by leaving it in a trust, which is why most people use a revocable trust for estate planning if they're advised, because it's already in a trust. So at their death, it just stays in trust for their spouse or their children in a way that's going to protect them from third parties. It doesn't go outright. And most children, if they're particularly well into adulthood, do not want assets outright where their spouse could get in a divorce. If they have a premarital agreement before they got married, most people don't, then maybe they won't be exposed, but otherwise, it will be potentially to spousal claims or creditor claims. The biggest cause of bankruptcies is medical bills. 550,000 bankruptcies a year, approximately, are due to medical bills. And if you leave assets in a trust for someone and they have medical bills, they're immune from any lawsuit like that. So it's just doing what you value as a family, passing it on your estate plan. And you want to protect children from things they cannot protect themselves against, as you did when they were minors, you leave it in a trust as opposed to outright. But most people just leave it outright, where it's fully exposed, high percentage. So if you take all these estate plans that don't even talk about the things we've talked about so far, even talked about taxes, we'll talk about that in a minute, but just those two things, protecting it from third-party claims and family harmony, that's the vast majority of estate plans don't have thoroughly thought out plans to preserve family harmony and protect the assets they leave their children from third party claims.
Right. So to slow it down a little bit, what can happen is people are upset for whatever reason, and they decide they're going to, you know, sue the estate or sue, you know, someone else to say, I should have got that, or I want that. But you can solve that through good estate planning. And really it comes down to a document that an attorney helps them create that governs what happens in a solid way.
Those situations, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
But the trouble is most lawyers, including myself, early in my career, till I really started drafting and have forms that would cover all these different situations, because if it's not in your forms, it's not going to be in your documents. Lawyers are not going to hand draft every document that comes in for those particular issues. It takes too long, too expensive. Their clients don't want to pay them for it, and they shouldn't have to pay for it. They're betting on the expertise they already have in their forms and advice so they can incorporate those efficiently in the estate plan. It's already available and drafted.
So what do you say to an attorney that might say, well, that trust is so thick, they can't even possibly read or understand all that's in there?
Yes, I kind of jokingly say, if a trust doesn't have 50 pages, it's not worth a damn. I joke about that, but it's
true.
But what you do is you cover all the what ifs that you can think of. And if you've got comprehensive forms, you can put in there taxes, lawsuits, everything, have a provision in the document. Well, that's going to make it longer. The idea, there's nothing simple about protecting assets from third-party claims, taxes, family harmony. All this is comprehensive, all these different issues. And H.L. Mencken had the quote, "For every complex situation, there's always a simple solution. Unfortunately, it's usually wrong." You cannot have a simple document that protects against complex situations like divorces, taxes, creditor claims, family disputes. If it doesn't cover it, you're just not covered. I often come back to the fact here in Wichita, I have insurance against tornadoes, earthquakes. Tornadoes used to be very common around here. I think they've moved east to here, but apparently not past our neighboring city of Andover, which had a tornado last year. But it's becoming less frequent. But whatever the frequency is, I can tell you what the frequency used to be before it's gotten the last several years not having very many. I had an insurance client, and he was an adjuster. And I was talking about protecting the things that are pretty unlikely. I said, "I don't know what the frequency of tornadoes are and hitting my house in Wichita." He said, "I can tell you, 400 to 1, a tornado or high wind is not going to destroy your house in Wichita over your entire lifetime or seriously damage it." Well, it's still worth the insurance I'm paying. The price I'm paying is worth it to me not to have to worry about that. Same thing with earthquakes. It's just the what ifs. But if it's not in the document, it's not an insurance policy, I'm not covered. If it's not in a trust or estate planning document, you're not just simply not covered.
My great-grandparents up in Topeka, that F5 tornado that went through a long time ago, they had their—
1966. It hit our law school, actually.
Yeah. So it took the roof off their house and all the family photos and heirlooms and stuff were gone.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, I had a client who— big Andover tornado in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. His wallet was found in the streets in Topeka.
Wow.
Yeah, that went that far. It went that far, that big tornado.
Holy cow.
And they picked it up. All the money was still in there, so they knew. It got blown all the way up there to Topeka.
That's amazing.
I gave him a call. Yes, just covering the what ifs. Now, most of these will never happen, so they won't even have to look at it. But it's also the adage, it's better need not have than have it not need it. So, I should have said revert. Better to have it not need it than need it not have it. Sure.
But the likelihood of an estate not going in a peaceable way without a really carefully drafted document is super high. It's not 400 to 1. It's
almost 50%.
Yeah, about 50%.
Yep,
flip
yep,
a coin.
Yep.
And you're dealing with the entirety of life savings, 401k, real estate, maybe business interest. The entirety of it's at a 50% risk of being either chewed up, given away, taken away somehow.
I might just quickly, a story I would gave a seminar out in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, a few years back. It was attorneys and CPAs that advise farmers and ranchers. 71 lawyers and CPAs in the audience. And I asked them, I said, "What percent of the time do you see significant family disharmony when a child is serving as a fiduciary of a parent's estate? There's more than one adult child." And I said, 0 to 25%. Four hands went up. Four thought it was that low. I said, 25 to 50%, about 30 hands. I couldn't count them. I was up at a podium, but about 30, I'd guess. I said, over half. There appeared to be a few more over half than under half. I don't think it's over half, but it's in the 40 to 50% range probably on the average whenever I do. And that's my feeling, what I've seen. So it's sad, but it's all avoidable.
Right.
Almost always avoidable.
In an insurance policy on a home, and we're only talking about the home and, well, I guess the contents too, but maybe if it's covering $500,000 worth of assets total, it's still going to cost you $2,000-$3,000 per year in perpetuity to protect that. But a trust document like what we're talking about is a couple, few thousand dollars maybe once. Or in some updates
along
the way.
And it covers the major components in addition to that. Who's getting my property? We're just talking about those additional clauses.
Yes.
That's going to cost a little more, but that's one time. If it's in the document and there's no premium every year, it's just going to be there if you need it.
Right. Yep. So the cost for bang for the buck is actually really incredible.
It is.
Yeah. Let's talk about taxes.
Okay. Well, right now there's about almost a $13 million federal estate tax exemption. And so most people are not subject to estate taxes. But there's a provision in our tax laws, federal level, It says that property is includable in your estate even if you don't pay any tax, like capital gains, property, stocks, real estate. The tax basis, that's the point at which if you sell it for more than that tax basis, you, capital gains, goes to fair market value. And so a lot of the planning now is to get a new basis in assets and client's property. So when it goes to a spouse or it goes to a child, it's got a new increased basis in it, so they won't pay that much tax when they sell it.
Right.
It's protecting it against creditor claims. It's also protecting against income taxes by doing that. So you can also do it to keep it out of their estate for estate tax purposes, but that's a pretty small minority right now. It's income taxes we're planning for now. Now, there's been actions at the federal level to try to get rid of that. None of that's passed yet, so they may get rid of it. Currently, we're planning to do that until they change the law. You might as well take advantage of the fact you don't have to pay any estate tax. That was $6 million you brought into someone's estate or spouse's estate or child's estate even, and they don't have to pay estate taxes on it, and they get a new basis. You can save a huge amount of income tax when that property is sold. But again, there's very little, I would say, inclination of most estate plans to have that in there because it's not planned for it. As advisors, as lawyers, we have to know how we can do that, take advantage of that. It's always those that know the rules are going to do better than those that don't. And if you know the rules of income tax, you can use what otherwise would be a sword by the IRS as a shield against taxes by including it in the estate but still not paying tax. They don't get any money but for the estate tax, and they don't get any money for the capital gains either because it got a new basis equal to fair market value.
Now, do all estate planning attorneys, and I'm making a broad question here, do all estate planning attorneys have to be trained in income taxes?
They have to know enough about how they impact estate plans. I'm fortunate enough to have a master's in tax, but I don't do a lot of income taxes anymore. But I know the income tax rules enough to know how you, when you do an estate plan, to take advantage of like such things as a new basis at death, if it's includable in your estate, to do that. But you do have no aspects or IRAs, retirement plans, those distribution rules. If it's going to a trust or estate, how much, how fast you have to have those paid out, how you can draft documents so you don't accelerate those distributions and accelerate income tax. Those aspects you need to know as lawyers, and most of them do, even if they don't have any training in that. If they practice a lot in that area, they will pick that up, or maybe they go to seminars and pick up on that. Unfortunately, the things we're talking about today, a lot of it, are not in seminars, like family harmony. Very few seminars even address those issues. So, like an afterthought.
I'll say at the time of the recording, my fiance, she gave a talk at Wichita State Planning Council on, it was soft skills. But for whatever reason, it was accepted by the other continuing education constituents like CFP, CLE, CPA, CE, but not CLE because they said it was too. But it had to do with, it was soft skills and how you engage a client to really draw them out, to really like get down to what's on their mind and connect. I mean, it's basic, but it's not really, but it wasn't seen as important enough, I guess, to the law department or for
to give credit for it.
Which is too bad. I hope that can change.
Well, thank goodness we don't have that in the legal field with family harmony estate planning. So they see that as value enough to to get credit for that. Yeah,
good.
Otherwise, I'd be doing far less seminars.
Right? Yeah, you do a few a year, right?
Quite a few. Yes.
Yeah.
And I might mention, Mike, in addition to income taxes, get the new basis equal to fair market value of death by including it in the estate.
Okay.
I'm not going to get into weeds and tell you how to do that, but it takes complex clauses to do that. But you can draft that. But also when you leave property in trust for children or spouses, they can only spend those assets for their own support and maintenance and health and education. They can also spend it for descendants, their kids. Like a surviving spouse can spend it for the children of the predeceased spouse. And the way trusts are taxed, I'll just give it in general category, if the income is left in that trust during lifetime and not distributed, lifetime of the beneficiary, then it's taxed at very high brackets if it's not distributed. It hits about the 40% bracket, close to that, at about $13,000 of accumulated income. If the income is distributed to a beneficiary, be it the spouse, be it to a child, if they're adult children, normally that's going to be taxed at their brackets. If their brackets are less than the spouse or less than the parent, like a trust for a child, they can make distributions to their own children when it's left in trust for a lifetime. You can save a lot of income tax over the lifetime of that beneficiary. Because even if you had, I'm just going to make up, let's assume we have 500,000 in there. I mean, what would be, would you say would be a good percentage of income? Not capital gains, just the interest, rents, royalties, dividends on an asset invested.
On 500,000?
Uh-huh.
A couple percent?
Three, maybe?
Yeah.
Pretty high. Yeah, on the average, maybe three. Traditionally, well, that would be 15,000 a year, wouldn't it?
Three would be, yeah.
So if that $15,000, let's say the spouse was the trustee, said, I don't need this money, I'm going to distribute it down to my children, who are just at a less than a 10% bracket, less than the surviving spouse, and maybe even lower than that, they're going to save $1,500 a year, aren't they? Well, that'd be 150. I mean, if you had $1,500 of basically income a year, 10%, that'd be 150 bucks only. But every year...
10% of 15,000 is 1,500.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for the dividends.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, that would be a 10% would be 150 bucks a year if it was lower, if it was distributed. But my point is, over a lifetime, you can save a lot of taxes that way. And a lot of these are a lot bigger than that. Farms and that type of stuff, if they get income, yeah, that could be several thousands of taxes saved every year by doing that. So not only have the flexibility to give their kids out of that trust and spend it for themselves, but also save income taxes on distributions. And you can also put a provision in that document, they can make distributions to charities of the income. And if you do that, you know how hard it is to itemize anymore for a couple, $24,000 before you can itemize. And so if you're not going to be itemized, most people give some money to charity. So if you could distribute that income to the charity instead of your own assets, which you can't deduct,
yep,
you're going to save income taxes on what you gave the charity. So
right.
We started incorporating stuff like that when they went to the basically a big, large standard deduction. We just changed our forms to allow that.
Yeah. So we've got some clients where we coach them to do, well, you know, I mean, we help them understand their options when it comes to how they give charitably.
Uh-huh.
And gift stacking in a year is one way to get through that standard deduction,
yeah,
and then maximize it moving forward, uh-huh, using a donor advised fund.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's a great point, where if they've inherited a certain amount of money
in a trust, like
in a trust, and they want to give that money instead, they don't have to, you don't even have to mess with it.
No.
What are the critical components, as you see it, to any estate plan? The major things that need to be protected, just so everybody understands, if you want to list them out.
Start with the major documents, for example.
Sure. Yeah, we can do documents.
It's how they're going to dispose of their assets, for example. Is it going to be through a will, or is it going to be through a revocable trust? Or we're just going to go out and name beneficiaries on all of our assets. Goes to the kids, get a death certificate, they're going to own all of our assets. Let's start with the last one first. If you have naming beneficiaries on all your assets, good luck that everything comes in the way that you want it to come out. Because first of all, what happens if that child predeceases you? Is it going to their kids or the other beneficiaries? Most people would want to go to grandkids. Well, you're going to end up with quite a complicated beneficiary designation if you're going to cover kids that are deceased going to their kids. In fact, a lot of third parties won't even take that as a beneficiary. So you're going to have to take a chance that a child is going to predecease and their kids are going to cut out of the estate plan if that's what you want. It's also going to go outright to everybody. Well, let's assume it goes outright to all the children. They all survive. Now they all own the house. They own the farm, all in equal shares. You talk about family disharmony, you're going to really start that. Everybody's a co-owner of the house. I want to sell it. I don't. Who's going to distribute the personal effects in the house? Nobody's in charge. All of that creates severe disharmony by doing that. So that's a way to do it. But most people, if they're advised, are not going to do that. Now, everybody is out to avoid probate. That's the number one goal, which my clients, when I talk to them, that should be the bottom goal. It's a goal. You certainly want to do that, but not in a way that's going to cause disharmony and have everybody a co-owner. If it's farmland, somebody's going to go and have a partition suit and force a sale of the whole property. Who's going to file mom or dad's last income tax returns if nobody's in charge? There's no executor. There's no trustee. You file it. No, you file it. Well, the IRS can come after anybody who got that property for taxes. So it's just not well planned if you go beneficiary designations typically. So you're left with, okay, I will leave it in terms of my will. I'll leave it to my kids that way. Or I'll even have a revocable trust during my lifetime. My death is going to go to my children. The two major ways to dispose of assets as opposed to beneficiary designations. Well, the will basically will avoid probate. I mean, the trust will avoid probate. The will not, because it has to go through probate to administer the estate. But avoiding probate is not the biggest goal. Is going through probate may cost, on the average, probably, if lawyers charge a percentage, I mean, let me go the other way. They charge an hourly rate and you convert it to a percentage. You divide what their fee is probably going to be, as opposed to the size of the estate as the denominator. It's probably going to be in the range of maybe 1%, maybe 2, just like a corporate fiduciary. So it's not the cost. People think it's going to cost a lot of money. It typically won't. Percentages tend to be too high. If they do charge 3 or 4%, California's got a percentage rate they can charge on estates, my understanding. So that's usually going to be too high as opposed to an hourly rate. But it's not high if they're doing hourly rates. And the other thing is, it doesn't take years, like people say, to go through probate. Kansas, if you do everything, get on the ball, get the will admitted to probate, appoint an executor. There's not all kinds of fights and feuds in the family, not a lot of complicated things with taxes or selling property. You could close out that estate within 6 months, usually. You have to wait 6 months because that's the time a creditor could file a claim in a state. So there's a 6 month get to wait for, but 6 months you could probably close it out. Now, so people go with trust because they don't have to go through probate to do it. It's a little less expensive on the average. It's not a matter of public record like wills are, who's getting my property. Some of these small communities, that's what they do. When someone dies, they go to the courthouse and see what the will says, who's getting the property. A lot of my clients, particularly from small communities, think that their friends and neighbors know way too much already. And so they've told their banker maybe they're worth a lot more than they really are. So anyway, I joke about that. They're going to find
out. Surely
not. Oh, no, that wouldn't happen. That credit they got, they deserved it. They had a lot of wealth. So those are reasons to avoid probate. It may be easier, private, not a matter of public record. And yes, it's somewhat less prone to creditor claims. So they use a trust. The question is, the trust itself will leave property at their death. This term, the next trustee we've been talking about, whether they leave it outright or it's already in a trust. So if you did it a will, you'd have to have a testamentary trust, a trust on the will created, court approved. So the trust, it's already a trust, it just stays in trust for the children or for a spouse. And maybe it's going to a spouse, then it goes down to children with all these asset protection, income tax savings provisions that we're talking about, usually. So that's what a trust would do. But a trust itself, even if you have a trust, is not your entire estate plan. What happens if you become disabled, you can put in the trust who my next trustee is to come in and manage my assets for me and pay my bills and take care of me. But it will not take care of anything that comes up outside the trust, as you will. IRAs, qualified plans, signing income tax returns, because revocable trusts do not file tax returns while you're living. It's all taxed back to the person who created it. So they're simple during lifetime. When it goes in trust for spouse or children, separate taxpayers like I was talking about, but they're not separate taxpayers while you're living to do that. But if something comes up outside, that trustee has no authority to go to retirement plan IRA and withdraw assets or change the custodian or change the investments. No authority, because it's not in the trust. If you tried to put an IRA in a trust, you'd have to pay the income tax on the entire IRA to do that. Nobody's going to do that. Very few that had the knowledge are not going to do that. So you need somebody that's going to be in charge to manage assets outside the trust. Now, if you didn't have any document but the trust, and assets came up outside the trust that you'd manage in, or filing your income tax returns or filing insurance claims, which have nothing to do with the trust, because it's not a trust income tax return, it's an individual tax return. This insurance claim is a personal claim that they have against the insurance company. If nobody was in charge of that, there's no authority of a spouse anywhere in the country to manage assets for a spouse because they're married. That authority has to be given to them. And the way that's typically given is through a financial power of attorney, authorizing that person to act on their individual behalf while they're disabled.
Right, because it's just like you can't call up your spouse's employer and say, well, I want to change their 401k investments.
Right.
You can't do it.
No. Yeah. Federal law says you have to have spousal consent. So anyway, that's the idea, is somebody who could do that. Because if they don't have a financial power of attorney and something outside the trust, that party is going to have to go to court and set up a conservatorship. Well, that's many thousands of dollars to do that. It's a matter of public record. They've got to have their spouse declared to be incapacitated, or their parent declared to be incapacitated, if it's a single person. And so if you want to avoid that, and you got ongoing costs for bonds, you got to post bond for that as a concern. You got to file annual accountings with the court. That's what happens if someone is disabled, don't have it's a trust, and something comes, or if they don't have a trust, that power of attorney's got to be used for everything, which means you have to go to court to get it, as we talked about. So you would have financial power of attorney, and that agent on the financial power of attorney is typically the same who would be the trustee if you have a trust, if you're incapacitated. And you can't be sure that everything's going to avoid probate even if you have a trust. What if you left something outside the trust that had to go through probate? It wasn't titled in the trust. The trust was not the beneficiary either. You have to go to court to see who the next owner of that asset is, because you own it in your individual name, wasn't in joint tenancy, didn't have a beneficiary, wasn't in a trust. The will is, you have a will that says if anything goes through probate, it goes to my trust. But you're going to have to go to court to do that. So you try to make sure all the assets are in there, but there's no guarantee that's going to happen. Or if somebody was killed in an accident, there'd be a wrongful death action probably. If they were, the other driver, for example, was at fault, that's going to be money of the estate. The will's got to cover that. It's not in a trust. You can't assign a claim in the future you don't even have. So that's called a pour-over will. If you have a trust, to pour it over to the trust. But it will have to go through probate to do that. So you have it just in case there's a probate asset. You also have a healthcare power of attorney. If you become disabled, can't make healthcare decisions, who's going to make healthcare decisions for you? And that's with the healthcare power of attorney. And even have a trust, usually, even if you went outside the family, we talked about third party perhaps to be the next trustee, you probably, no third party trustee is going to want to be the healthcare agent. And you're probably going to be a family member that you're going to name. That avoids a guardianship. So usually a spouse, if you're married, is going to be the healthcare. It's not managing finances, it's just making healthcare. So even like a second marriage, you're going outside the family for the next trustee, healthcare, they're probably going to use a spouse to make those healthcare decisions for you if you're incapacitated and need healthcare decisions.
Yeah. Let's say we're in Kansas, though, because we are. Mm-hmm. In Kansas, does the spouse automatically get that ability?
No.
Really?
A spouse has no rights, I know, of anywhere in the country. Now, I think they have some statutes if you don't have a healthcare power of attorney, and some we don't have one of those.
Okay.
Where they have a hierarchy who can make those decisions.
Okay.
But in Kansas, and I think most other states, I could be wrong on this, but I think most other states, if you don't have a healthcare power of attorney and there's a healthcare decision made, your only option is going to be guardianship. Go to court and set up a guardianship. And that's also going to be very expensive, just like a conservatorship. The difference is you don't have to post bond like you do in finances, because you're not making financial decisions. You're only making healthcare decisions. That helps.
I didn't realize that it didn't apply. I thought in Kansas, the spouse had, I guess this shows how misinformed I was. I thought in Kansas, the spouse had the ability to make a medical decision if the other one was incapacitated.
No.
Wow.
I'm not going to tell you that doctors might not go along with what the spouse says.
Sure.
But there's no legal way to do
that. Legally speaking, it's not really there.
They're not
going to
get sued by going ahead and making a good decision anyway. They're probably not concerned about any lawsuits by doing that, but there's no authority under the law to do those.
Yeah. And so that goes back to the famous Terry Schiavo case.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a living will.
Okay.
If I get the place, I cannot make healthcare decisions, and either I am persistent vegetative state, permanent coma, perhaps, or I'm terminally ill with no hope for improvement, can't make a decision. I don't want any healthcare procedures just to unduly prolong my life, is typically what they say.
Mm-hmm.
That's the living will. That takes it out of the hands of that healthcare agent to have to make that decision.
Okay, so that's separate. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I was jumping ahead.
That's okay. That's the last document.
Okay.
So you have trust. If you have revocable trust, you have a pour over will, you have a financial power of attorney, and you have a living will. But, so I don't have to have a healthcare agent does not have to make that. That's very traumatic. I probably don't have to tell
you
that.
Yeah.
For a child to have to make a decision to terminate life support in a parent.
Absolutely.
And clients say, well, they know what I want. Well, I've seen situations where they couldn't even make that decision. Couldn't bring themselves to, I can't do it. And if they do, sometimes their siblings will disagree with them. In fact, one of them, my clients, the sibling made that decision to terminate life support. And one of the other siblings said, you killed mom. I mean, got that vindictive, that vitriolic. So by having the living will, it says, I'm making that decision. The doctor's going to have my living will. If I rise, and typically, it just covers terminally ill with the hope for improvement. The last several years, I've expanded mine because you have a constitutional right to make your own healthcare decisions, even if you're disabled and incapacitated. So you can draft them any way you want, basically. So I covered, as you were talking about, Terry Schiavo situation, permanent coma, persistent vegetative state, no hope for ever gaining capacity again. stop all life support, all healthcare decisions. Any healthcare procedure that's going to just unduly prolong my life, stop it if I'm in that circumstance, and don't even apply it if it hadn't been applied yet. So that will take care of that. And the third thing that I've added, because I knew a lot of clients would want this, dementia, Parkinson's, brain injury disease. If someone gets to the place, they don't recognize family or friends, have no idea where they're even, sense of place, even where they're located, and that's going to be persistent. Tested for like three times during a 30-day period, no chance that they'll ever regain that capacity again. Two doctors diagnose it. The doctor said, don't say certify. We don't certify, we diagnose. So I put certify or diagnose in there. That you're in that condition, stop all medical care. Just keep me comfortable. It's called comfort care. Keep me painless. I don't care if it's narcotics. Just keep me comfortable, but don't give me anything that's going to just prolong my life. No heart medicine, no cancer medicine. In fact, I had a client come in not too long after I drafted this with the help of two doctors who were clients, two doctors who weren't clients, and the chaplain of the Harry Hines Hospice here in Wichita helped me out too in drafting this to what to put in it. She came in, I was kind of in general term telling what it does, and she says, okay, so I'm a type 1 diabetic. I'm on insulin. They're going to stop insulin if I'm in that condition? I said, yes. I'm going to stop dialysis too. That's another one in there. I thought she was going to say, I don't want that. Hippocratic oath, do no harm. She said, that's what I want. Perhaps maybe it's a family member, maybe just a patient that she's seen that in. So that's what she wanted to do. But not everybody, but high percentage would not want to be kept alive with that type of condition.
Yeah.
So in conjunction with a healthcare practitioner and a living will, they won't be. My healthcare agent will make decisions in every situation, but if I get that place, I'm telling the doctors, stop. My children don't have to make that decision, or my wife, or my husband, like a second marriage.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I watched my grandpa wither away taking care of my grandma on my dad's side. I mean, now he's alive. He lived, but he lost all kinds of weight trying to do it all himself. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, he just felt that responsibility. Now, I'm not saying they would have done anything different if they had the option, but it takes such a toll on the loved ones that don't get the dementia.
Well, that's what I had to help from the Chaplain Harry Hines Hospice here in Wichita. I want my wishes to be honored. Why? I want my family to remember as I was, not as I am in this condition. And it gets into even the cost of keeping someone alive in that condition too. It mentions that, but just primarily, I just don't want to be left in that condition for my family. I want to just stop all medical care. So, and the doctors do have to honor it. Under state law, if they won't, they have to give it to somebody who will.
Yeah, and everybody makes their own decisions when it comes to it. And I hope that they are thinking about that for themselves in advance and putting things in place like the legal documents that would do what they want to do, to take it out of the hands of those that do love them. And it's just too difficult of a decision to put on somebody else. But even for myself, when I was growing up, I learned that about 1% of males go crazy, proverbially between the age of like 18 and 26. So, but there's that corridor in there where you see
schizophrenia.
Yeah. You become a prisoner of your own mind. And that was actually my greatest fear of like, if I was afraid of anything, it was of going crazy because you're still alive, but you are not experiencing reality as it is. You're a prisoner of your own mind. It's,
I was a psychology major and I've learned a lot about that type of thing being in practice.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I learned, that schizophrenia tends to not show up till adulthood.
Yep.
In males, it's around age 20.
Yep.
In females, it's around closer to 40. A neurologist told me that. I didn't realize with females it was different, but it apparently is. Which gets down to, if you're doing estate planning, you don't know what children are going to be like at that age. So if you have clients coming in who have minor children, they have no idea for sure what they're going to be like at 20, 30, or 40, or they're going to be on drugs, those type of things. So we didn't talk about this earlier, but one of the things in the estate plan, family harmony, is I want to make sure it doesn't go to them too much too soon. If their values, I want to make sure they're motivated. I want to make sure that they don't get it if they're on drugs. or mental illness, then you have to put that in the documents. What happens if this happens? What if this happens? Too much too soon is usually they maybe don't take over their own trust till 35. 35 is my most common age now for kids taking over their own trust. They leave in trust for a lifetime to protect them from third parties, but they don't take over their own trust till they get to that age. And maybe they have 2 years of a tutelage to learn about trust before they just take it over to hopefully mollify against the lottery syndrome here.
I think that's really wise.
And so whether it's 35 or 40, they can take over. So, and I've had clients also, this gets a little bit further in development as I've gone on, is if they want to make sure it doesn't be a disincentive to their own motivation. So while it's in trust, maybe it's very conservative for maintenance support until they reach that age when they would take it over, because they want to make sure it doesn't interfere with their personal motivation, financial independence, or lead to a premature exhaustion of the trust estate. It puts it in the docket. Very conservative. In fact, it might even say the basic necessities of life. I want them to get by on their own. I want them to have motivation. I'm motivated. I want to motivate my children to get by on their own, to succeed. And I don't do that by giving them too much money too soon. And I was telling you about that Warren Buffett quote, which you may have been aware of earlier, where he said, I want to give my children enough so they can do anything, but not so much they can do nothing. And that happens. I've seen a lot in the past. I don't do that anymore because I see what happens. But in terms of, I advise my clients more thoroughly. I did just out of law school. But if you have those provisions in there, then they're going to get by on their own. Going to have to. They're not going to be starving. They're not going to have a health care need that can't satisfy, because it's for that. But it's not going to be given them for a high lifestyle. They want a new car at age 24? Don't think so. Maybe you've got a car, we'll fix up your car, but we're not going to give you a new car for all those reasons. So I tell clients that trustee is your surrogate. You have family values when they're growing up. What are your family values when you're gone in terms of giving the money for this or giving the money for that? And if you don't want them to have a disincentive, the documents need to be in there, because otherwise they're going to read it basically. Need a new car? We'll just give them a new car, the trustee. So if you had a 24-year-old child coming to you for money, hypothetically, let's say they have minor kids, 24 years of age, what are you going to say? You're probably going to say you've got a job if you're out of school. You know, do you have any other assets that would pay for this? Because if you do, why is the trust paying? It's always going to be there protected for life. They should probably use their own assets first before they come to the trustee for additional money.
Help them self-resource.
Exactly. And that's what I'd say. Well, if I had a 24-year-old child, I'm going to say, don't you have any other assets? Well, your wife has got money. You know, she's got a good job. She has an obligation to support you. No, we're not going to do that. I mean, what are the other reasons? What would you be asking? So that trustee should be asking the same questions you would be asking had you lived.
Sure. If you think about it, I guess what comes to mind as you're describing giving too much too soon is, if somebody doesn't have to figure out how to make it on their own, or how to self-resource, how to earn income, how to come up with what they need, or downsize what they need, because maybe they're living beyond their means.
Sure, sure.
Or they're obviously beyond their means and they're just trying to use whatever else as a crutch. But what comes to mind is that the social experiment with money, where you give even amounts to money to a certain amount of people, and before too long, you've got a small percentage of the people with most of the money.
Yeah.
Because they're good with money. They're disciplined with it.
Yeah.
And most are not, but if you apply that thought or that experiment that's been done several times with the same result, essentially, and you apply it to anybody who's going to be inheriting a large amount of money, if they don't understand financial discipline, they don't understand it. And it doesn't matter how much money you hand them. If they have it without any guardrails, they're not going to magically handle it well or wisely.
If you hold it back later, you've got a greater chance they've gained some maturity in growing up.
Right.
I'll give you another story. I had a client come in many years ago. Her father gave her half, in his estate plan, gave her half the assets when she got to 40. It was just left in trust, the balance at 50. She came in to do her estate planning. And she told me, she said, at age 40, I've just been through a divorce. I spent money because it made me happy. Spent it all. pretty quickly. But I have every dime he gave me at 50. You never know these Santa things. Or maybe they're going bad time in life, drugs, alcohol, whatever it is, and they get it straightened out. They have the opportunity to gain maturity. And if you want to, you can even, I've had clients that just said, okay, they're going to take over at 65. I had a couple, and hopefully I had time to do the story. They had about $800,000, a couple, two children in their 30s. I'll never forget this, and it made an impact upon me. And they said, well, if we both pass away, we want to make sure our children get it when they can. We talk about leaving trust. They like the idea of leaving trust. They take over their own trust to protect them from spouses and creditors. But they want the question is, when are they going to take over their own trust? So they thought maybe they'll take over in their 30s. Maybe they serve 2 years to learn about taxes and maybe mollify against the lottery syndrome a little bit by not getting it immediately. But they said, but after 2 years, they just take it over, no matter what age. And I said, okay. Are your children savers? No. No. Do they have pretty good income? No. Well, you kind of know what's going to happen there. It's going to be gone quickly. So I just prompt them thinking about what that would mean to them in terms of what they're going to have later in life. They probably aren't going to have much in Social Security, which doesn't pay for everything anyway. We're not even close to it. Probably don't have much in a 401k or IRA either. Odds are they're not going to. So we went through that aspect of it. So they kind of knew it'd probably be gone pretty quickly if that happened. And I talked about maybe leave it later in life or thinking about that. Just that's a possibility. And I remember the wife saying, we don't want to rule from the grave. I've heard that one a lot. I said, you're going to rule from the grave no matter what you do. How you give your money and assets to your children are going to affect their lives. Do you want to affect it in a positive way or perhaps a negative way? And then they got into, well, if they blow it, they blow it. Well, I've heard that one too. Sure. You probably have too. I said, okay, but yet you might consider what costs. They have a standard of living they can't support anymore. I've seen that happen. They start getting fights and feuds. Who spent the money? Drugs, alcohol, maybe even spousal abuse. And so you have a fractured family often when that happens, and they can't support that lifestyle anymore. Maybe they'd be better off if you hadn't given to them in the first place, or think about that. And just on their own, they decided to leave in trust till 65. Nothing immediately, just leave in trust. Manage it well. They'll probably get all income off that trust because we have a provision that they could probably get the income because you want to leave it in trust and have the high taxes. So they'll get the income every year, but the principal is going to grow, hopefully. So at 65, they've got a retirement plan that they otherwise wouldn't have. But when I have clients that actually do that, and I'm more and more starting to do that, thinking about that, are we in service giving them too much too soon? And so we put a provision in the document. I'm leaving a trust for this, not because I didn't trust my kids properly manage it, although sometimes that's the case. I'm doing it because protecting them against those things in life that can happen to any of us, you know, divorces, bad investments, disabilities, to where they're left with no assets when they're older. I didn't want this to happen to you. I want to make sure no matter what happens to you in your lifetime, things that you can't really protect could happen to anybody, that you're left with a retirement and age. And it puts in the document, if you don't spend the assets you have and left with no savings, you'll never miss this. If you do, hopefully you'll take some solace that you've got assets for your retirement when you get older. So that, I never forgot that whole incident. They just, on their own, I gave them potential, but they decided that's what they thought through it. I think they've got to do that. But that's not given by many lawyers as an option. Give it out a certain age and with hope they're mature. Well,
or just a pass-through trust.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot just of pass-through trusts.
Just income?
Where it's just distributed.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it'll technically be a trust, so it avoids probate, mm-hmm. and then it's just given out to the beneficiaries, and it skips all the creditor protection, all the other types of protection that a trust offers.
Yeah, they just don't even do it.
Yeah.
So but it's some education that we have as lawyers to educate our clients. I don't care what they do. I remember another client, I'll give you one more story, out in central Kansas, maybe about a $3 million estate. 15, 20 years ago, maybe. That was worth a lot more then than it is now, of course, with inflation and everything. But he had several kids, and he said, I know what you're talking about leaving in trust. We hadn't got to when they could take over their own trust. He said, here's the way I look at it. That's not my problem. Whatever they get is gravy. If it's gone, it's gone. I just want to keep it simple. Just give it outright. My response was, that's the right decision for you. My job is to tell you the pros and cons, not telling you what you ought to do. I try not to recommend anything. The facts speak for themselves. Here's what this does. I'm sure that's the way investments, right? Here's your risk with this, and here's your potential return. Here's your another type of investment. Well, same thing with estate planning. Pros and cons, you adequately inform and take the time to do that. And most of us, including myself, or the micro, didn't take enough time. I usually have a 2-hour initial conference going through their values, where they're coming from, and make sure the plan matches their values. And sometimes they have to think about this. Often the first conference, they're not going to think about when they're going to take over their own trust. That's just an option we discuss later. But you have to advise them of it, or they have not made an informed decision. And whatever informed decision they make is the right decision for them. No question about it.
Yeah. And that's great advice, because they've got to own it. It's their stuff. It's their decision. They have to own it. They can't, you don't, and there's no sense in anybody coming back later and saying, well, Tim O'Sullivan talked him into this. But, you know, that doesn't help anybody.
I actually had that happen once. And I learned a lesson. Very early in my career, I came out of law school. I was going to do revocable trust. I learned about it. I said, I think that's going to be the next coming thing. Well, it was, but not many people were doing them when I got out of law school. So I had a client come and said, I think this would be a good thing for you to have, revocable. Here's what it does, et cetera. That's what he did. Well, he started reading stuff, and back then there were a lot of lawyers and everybody else were writing articles negative about revocable trusts. No court supervision, blah, 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 blah. But it wasn't a very balanced approach. So they came in, he just wanted to terminate the trust, which I don't think was a very good idea, but you know, it's his decision. He said, you talked me into this. He was right. I did. That's the last time I ever recommended one thing or another. Even living wills, no, that's a healthcare decision. And just like when my clients come in for a living will, if they have their kids with them, and usually that's not a very good idea. We could talk about that in just a minute, but they ask their kids, well, what do you think about this provision of living will? I just cut it off. I said, that's your decision. You probably don't want the kids to feel like the burden of having to make that decision for you. That's like, you might as well have it in your healthcare power of attorney. And it is. It should be the parents' decision. They should not rely on kids to make those decisions for them. It's the same thing. They need to make an independent decision that's right for them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Owning our decisions is a huge source of peace.
Oh, it is. It is.
Yeah.
And they usually will say, people I knew when I came over to Wichita from Hutchinson, where I initially practiced out of law school, I heard that basically that, oh, they want to keep it simple. They're not going to want complicated. Well, there's nothing simple about estate planning. You need to explain it to them. Most of the stuff we have in the back of the documents is stuff that everybody would pick. Like there's like 7 or 8 pages maybe of minimizing taxes, income taxes and other things. It has nothing to do with who's getting the property, when they're getting it, or how they're getting it. It has everything to do with how much is there. So usually if this tax provision is needed, it's there. Same thing with trustee powers. If they need these powers to do something, sell land, you know, it needs to be there. So they have the authority to do that. So I really don't care if my clients read those provisions. I know they come in and said, I don't think I want that tax provision. First of all, I have to spend a couple hours telling them what it does. After which they're going to say, I still want that then.
Like, well, yeah, maybe it's okay to leave it.
Yeah, maybe it's okay to pay it, the federal government. No, they don't come to that decision. So it's just one of those things. Like I had a client to died, and I got a call before Christmas by her son. Left a generation skipping trust. He took over his own trust probably immediately. And he said, I'm getting tired of this, having to file this income tax return every year. He said, I just want to terminate my trust and take it outright. I said, well, technically, legally, you can't do that. It's just for your health support maintenance, pay for your needs, not terminate, just put it in your own name for any reason. I said, probably nobody's going to challenge that. Your kids won't, because they'll be disinherited if they do that. You have the right to change how it goes among your family. I said, here's what that trust does for you. I said, it's the difference between leaving in a Brinks truck versus an open pickup. That's my metaphor, which it is. And then going through all these things to protect against. And he said, I think I'll leave it in trust. Long-term care, divorces, all those type of things. Protect it.
Yeah, and the best part is great as some of the solutions that you're talking about, they're all legal.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Sure.
There's nothing shady about it. It's provided for in our laws.
Yeah, I got a chance to draft the last statute on asset protection that Kansas passed in 2014 on these trusts. we have the Uniform Trust Code, which is in about 35 states now, but we modified the provisions slightly to make sure these assets were protected. I think they probably were anyway, but we changed the stat. The Real Property Probate and Trust section of the bar proposed that they make quite clear that even if you're serving as your own trustee of these trusts, no third parties can reach it. And that was put in law in 2014. So
yeah, thanks for doing that.
Yeah. I actually had a client call me. Let me rephrase that. It was the attorney for a hospital here in Kansas. I drafted a trust for a lady. She left property and trust for her son, and generation skipping trusts like this, what they're called. They're called generation skipping, not because they're skipping going to grandkids. They're skipping that person's taxable estate. They're skipping their creditors. They're skipping their spouse in terms of creditor claims. That's who they're skipping, but they're still the beneficiary of that trust, primary beneficiary. And ran up a big hospital bill to son. And that the hospital got a big judgment against him for that bill. I don't even know what it was, but it did not have enough insurance or none at all. And he called me. I said, I see you drafted this trust for this lady, and she left in trust for her son. It's for his health, education, maintenance, support. He just ran up a big hospital bill. We have a big judgment against him, and we're going to go to court and have the judge force him to pay it for his health, pay us off. Hadn't read the statute. Thought it suggested. I never got a call back. That was it. No claim. He didn't have a claim against that trust. If you read what advice is out there, the advice is tell the kids about the estate plan, your kids about the estate plan, because it clears the air and avoids surprises. Not my experience. Most of the time, it creates all these different problems. Why wasn't I named trustee, particularly if you're going outside the family? All these other issues come up. Dad, if I died first, I want my inheritance go to my spouse. Well, most clients don't want to go to in-law. So you bring up all these other issues, many more that I could bring up. It usually is a big negative. And so unless you have a farm or closely held business, you have a business succession plan about taking it over.
Yeah.
Who's going to do that? You need to try
that. That obviously needs to be explained.
Oh, exactly.
But
not who's getting and whether they're getting and how they're getting it.
Yeah.
And they're going to argue, gee, Dad, I think I can manage it before 40 years of age. I'm 25. I just leave it or I take it over immediately, you know, if they want to trust. So it brings up all these different issues that you wouldn't have and a lot of disharmony while you're living. So it's just usually not, in my opinion, not a very good idea. That goes against conventional wisdom. Certainly goes against what you see in most websites of lawyers that say clear the air and avoid surprises. I've had more bad things happen by doing that than good things, and by far. And once in a while, I have a client say, well, I told my kids about the estate plan. They didn't have a problem with it. My response is, you didn't need to tell them, did you? You're only going to find out when they do have a problem with it. So, yeah, it didn't clear the air. They can find out. And you can put in the first part of the document why you're doing everything you're doing. That's when you explain it to them. Why I'm leaving in trust as opposed to outright. I'm protecting you from things you can't protect yourself against if you got it outright. So you put that in the first part of the document, not where you're living. Okay, so we'll go on with what you're doing.
All right. So what is the best thing to tell them? Or to what level of explanation should you give them?
I've got a tight estate plan. They know about avoidable probate. It avoids probate. We shouldn't have any probate assets. We've got all, we're fair to, we think, all of you kids. We've got it well designed. It's very complex. I'd have a real hard time. A lot of tax clauses in there, et cetera. So hopefully dissuade them from even going any further than that. Just tell them it's in good shape, well thought out. It's a good estate plan.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah. And that right there should give them enough peace that if
sure
you know that you've done the work, they're not going to inherit a total mess. And there's been careful thought to be fair about
yes,
things.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So why don't you talk a little bit about blended family versus non-blended? So just blended family, how is that with estate planning?
It's the most complicated estate plan of all. It's fraught with the most family disharmony. But kids on both sides, whether it's second marriage, third marriage, whatever, if the spouses have kids from prior marriages, that is the riskiest. And it's very risky to having a child come in as a fiduciary in that type of estate. You're probably up to 90% risk of huge disharmony and costs. I've seen it happen time after time after time. Or perhaps the worst of all is, we're going to name a child on both sides to be co-trustees. Or I tell them, that's like What, cats?
Yeah.
That's exactly what I tell them. Like tying the tail of two cats together.
Yeah.
You're about 100% chance that's going to crash.
Yeah.
So going outside the family is something to think about. And actually, so I have a blend of families. Let's assume that the first death, they're going to leave in trust for the surviving spouse for their needs, but then it's going to come back to their kids. Well, fine. But you probably don't want the spouse to be the, and they may not want to be in the middle of spending those assets and how they're going to distribute assets for themselves, because the stepkids are going to wonder how they're spending assets. They're spending too much money. How much is going to be left for them? So often you would say, well, I want to go outside the family, a third party, have a bank be a co-trustee, for example, with my spouse. So if the first death, they come on, then they'll be in the trust, a holding trust for the surviving spouse. So you got somebody watching the store, so to speak, making sure everything is spent correctly. And maybe it wasn't anything of an intent. The surviving spouse starts losing their capacity and influence. They start distributing it basically to their kids instead. Sure. You know, it's not going to happen if you have a co-trustee, because everything's got to be approved. But if they don't like that co-trustee, they can fire them, go down to some co-trustee, but we get somebody that's watching the store. So the first spouse is going to, when they pass away and leave it in trust, then they basically are going to say that we've got a third-party trustee, basically. They leave a letter to their kids why they're doing it. Don't give it during lifetime, of course. Death, that's when it gets distributed to their children, saying why they did what they did. We've got a co-trustee. It's well-managed. And you can even have certain property go at the first death, maybe the kids of the first spouse. But having a spouse be the trustee and that whole thing is just, without getting the weeds even further and how you could even make sure there's no problem whatsoever, you can do it so a way that, and it gives the spouse peace too. I don't have to deal with my stepkids over that. The issue, the bank is a co-trustee. They're managing the estate. Personal effects in the home, I don't have to argue over who gets what. They're dividing it all up. So it gets a third party in there, so it removes them from that type of problem. Because most people do not want their surviving, even second marriages, their surviving spouse to have to go through that with their own kids over these type of issues. So it gives them peace of mind that their spouse is going to be taken care of. You got peace in the family, and they can't disrupt anything. You can have an interim clause if they cause problems. They're going to be disinherited. But that money is going to be well managed. It's going to be there for them, whatever's left. That's just one type of plan. They can get even more complex than that. But you can plan to avoid disharmony.
Yeah.
Costly disharmony, financially and administratively.
Right. So the complexity goes up. The opportunities for misunderstanding goes up.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And that's how you have, you know, like you talk about, a 90% chance that people are not going to get along.
Yeah. And that's going to be ka-ching, ka-ching, fees.
Yeah, some attorneys enjoy that part.
Well, that's what I tell them. What I'm telling you is not my economic interest. It isn't. Right. It isn't. But it's in your interest. Fees you spent for lawyers after death are not in your interest. Costs and planning and avoid that are.
Yeah. Yeah, what? Probate attorneys' fees can stack up quite quickly, can't they?
Yeah, but family feuds are really expensive. Litigation.
Right.
Oh, man. So, I mean, you could take out a huge portion of the estate just in lawyer fees.
Yeah, you think a divorce attorney's bad.
Yeah.
Go fight over a whole estate.
Yeah. I like avoiding family fights and feuds.
Yeah.
I did a little bit of family law. I hated it.
Yeah.
You're dealing with the worst elements of human nature. Running up. And I like to plan so you avoid those problems.
So one of your old partners, Eric Milgren, one of the funny things he said, he's like, yeah, he said family court and criminal court are funny because in family court, you actually typically have decent people, but they're behaving at their worst.
Oh, yes.
And in criminal court, you have people that are not decent trying to behave their very best.
Exactly. We see that all the time. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, man.
But a well-conceived estate plan is not simple.
Yeah.
You see these ads on TV, check the box of how you want your property to go to. We'll give you a will or trust.
Well, sounds like a good idea.
It sounds, but it's not covering all these issues we're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's not even touching the surface of those issues.
No, it's not. So, moral of the story is it's very worthwhile to take the time to do a well-thought-out estate plan with a very practiced and refined process firm attorney that specializes in estate planning. One of the comments I'll make from observation is a general practicing attorney isn't as well trained in estate planning as maybe they ought to be, because it's such a nuanced area of practice.
It is.
It's so nuanced.
It is, and it's they don't have the forms for it. They don't have the knowledge for it, and they have to practice in too many areas to get that knowledge. Even
what was the one? So at Wichita Estate Planning Council last week, he rolled through, man, like 20 different famous celebrity estate.
Bad estate plans.
Yes, uh-huh. There was the one who was it that they asked the person who was the attorney who was in charge of their music rights.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, he's not an estate planner. So he apparently pulled up an online form.
Oh, yeah.
Used it.
Which is better than nothing, but not much better. Yeah.
It was not much better.
No.
Yeah, it was a train wreck, and it probably turned out still extremely expensive in court.
Oh, yeah.
But
that's where we should get our satisfaction, in avoiding problems.
Yes.
Planning, not on the back end.
Yep.
If I see something in the back end I could have avoided, it's going to go right in my form so it doesn't happen with the next person.
Yeah, and thankfully you've been around doing that quite a while, so a lot of that stuff is handled in your forms.
Well, that's the old adage of Will Rogers. Good judgment comes from experience, and most of that comes from bad experience. That's true. That is true.
Yeah. Thanks for going ahead.
Yeah. I don't want it to happen to me. Even if it's something I've seen and not, I don't want it to happen to my clients. You put it right in your forms.
You live and breathe it every day, and you're passionate about it. And we're here to help people make wise financial decisions. And this is part of it, is managing what you've built and giving it in a way that is going to
further family values.
Family values, harmony, instead of turning into something divisive, however unintentional.
And protecting your family members from third-party claims
along
the way, sure.
Yep. So do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to impart with, Tim?
No, my passion has been in that area. And just hit me, you know, after about maybe 15 years of practice, this isn't going right. I see all these fights and feuds.
Mm-hmm.
And I had kind of an epiphany. It wasn't on the road to Damascus like St. Paul. It was probably on Highway I-70 or somewhere. I was just driving along. Whoa, it just hit me. And so I went back and let's just redo all my documents towards these ends and make sure we accomplish these and explaining it to clients. And yes, they'll put up with long documents if you explain it to them. But when I get the tax clauses, I'll just tell them it minimizes taxes. If I go through every clause, you probably won't want every one of those in there if it ever happened to you. Like your insurance policy. You have flood in the basement, you hope that you've got that covered in your insurance policy. So anyway, just doing it now. We keep doing it and done it for a number of years. It's worked out pretty well in terms of the goals we have. But I'm trying to get my fellow attorneys more tuned into doing that. Because family harmony is not anywhere near the upper tier of estate plans as a goal. We lawyers are good at technical things, taxes, avoiding probate, but that's not the most important things that we're talking about here. So, I mean, it's very simple. Anybody can do that. They can build a frame of a house, but how you build everything goes in it. I mean, it's just, so get beyond just the basics of these other things. And I think I'm starting to have some luck in that in terms of getting my fellow attorneys to do that, but it is not easy. When I did an article for Marquette Law School back in 07, I asked him, I'd like to do one in family harmony. So I put it together, but I'm always going to go back and see whatever anybody else has written on that subject. I couldn't find one other article in the country for lawyers dealing with family harmony, not one. So I knew it wasn't taught. I didn't have any course in law school about it. It wasn't even mentioned. But I think it's starting to come. I got invited to another state to do a practical strategies on that particular issue. I'm going to do probably in the next month or two. Invited me, they saw that article, want me to do it for their particular, it was in Illinois. We'll see if I do that, but I think it's going to be, the more we can get that out, the word out, the more that people are going to have better estate plans. It is not simple. I mean, I want to keep this simple. They all come in thinking they're going to have a simple estate plan and tell you, what if this happens? So you make sure, I want to make sure that's covered. Well, it's got to be in the documents like we're talking about, but they will understand if you explain it to them. They'll usually go away with, not, this is too complicated. It's more like, well, you've got everything covered. No, I don't have everything covered. Everything I know about, but you can't cover everything. Once you think you're going to cover, you've covered everything, you're going to be in for a fall at some point in time, but you always have to be open to adding new things, but hopefully it covers most of these things. So the chances of bad things happening with that particular client are pretty slim. If they do the family values, estate plans like we're talking about, that's what's going to be covered. And you shouldn't have the risk of having that problem. Is like a well-insured house. You're not going to probably have something come up that you don't have insurance for.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. O'Sullivan, for sharing of your many, many years of experience.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that.
And I look forward to any future talks we have.
Okay. All righty.
All right. Well, that'll do it for today on Real Wealth Podcast, sponsored by Leading Edge Financial Planning. And today, Mr. O'Sullivan from Folston Siefkin.